Good evening and welcome behind the news for February 19, 2004. This is Ed Dykendron, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. And I've got a very full schedule tonight, so let's keep the pace moving here. First, will be an interview with recorded earlier today with Sarah Roy, who is a Middle Eastern specialist at Harvard, talking about conditions of life on in the occupied territories in Palestine. And then towards the bottom of the hour, some excerpts from a presentation yesterday by one of the richest men in the world, George Soros, who is dedicating a lot of his money to defeating George Bush this fall. He gave that before the assembled members of the ruling class in the Council on Foreign Relations. Recorded some excerpts of it and put it together, and you'll be hearing those at about 24 after the hour, I hope. And then, just after the half hour, we'll be joined in the studio by Christian Parenti, who has made his second trip to Iraq the month of January and wrote it up for The Nation, and is also in the process of writing a book for the New Press about the soldiers, the U.S. soldiers in Iraq mostly. But Christian spent some time hanging out with the 82nd Airborne and meeting some members of the resistance, and we'll hear from him what he saw on his trip to Iraq last month. And since time is short, just a couple of words. I should announce also, as I did last week, tonight at 7:30 p.m. at the Brecht Forum, 122 West 27th Street, excerpts from a film called 21st Century by two Italian filmmakers, Gabriele Zamperini and Lorenzo Miccoli, a documentary about the historical period in the U.S. surrounding the September 11th, 2001 attacks and the anti-war movement that emerged in response. So there's a conversation with activists, intellectuals, journalists, and religious leaders about oil, patriotism, war, and resistance, selections of the film, and then a Q&A with the directors. That's tonight at the Brecht Forum, 7:30 p.m., 122 West 27th Street in Manhattan. And just a couple of words about the economic headlines. The weekly count of initial jobless claims that released this morning fell a bit more than expected, reversing a couple of weeks of increase. So it looks like the modest firming in the job market that indicator has been outlining is continuing. But interestingly, the measures of confidence, such as the ABC magazine, Money Magazine weekly measure, and the University of Michigan's monthly measure, have taken quite a tumble in the last few weeks, and that's very interesting. It seems like the persistent weakness in the job market is finally taking a toll on consumer attitudes, which is also, I think, being reflected in the political polls, which are showing increasing doubts and hostility towards George Bush. And so while the job market does seem to be firming, it's not firming that much. So it does seem to be taking its toll on confidence. We'll see if what this happens over the next several months, but something worth following. Just one more word. The Japanese economy, it was reported the other day, or yesterday, I believe, expanded at a 7% annual rate at the end of last year, a very, very fast rate of growth. And now the Japanese economy has seen positive growth numbers for four quarters in a row. It's averaging about 4% year on year. So it looks like the Japanese economy, after about a decade of stagnation, does seem to be finally getting up off the mat. So we'll see if that is a more permanent trend or just a little blip in a longer period of trouble. And now, just move right along to listen to Sarah Roy, who is a senior research scholar at the Harvard University Center for Middle Eastern Studies, a frequent visitor to the West Bank and Gaza Strip, frequent writer about life in those areas, an economist by training, deeply humanist by temperament. So let's listen to Sarah Roy.
Last time we talked, the conditions were quite dire in the territories. I imagine things have gotten only worse since we've talked.
Yes, unfortunately, and quite tragically, they have. The building of the separation barrier has worsened already acute conditions in ways that we really don't hear much about in this country. Although there is a lot of information available, it doesn't really seem to get discussed in the popular media, at least in this country. The barrier has had an absolutely devastating effect already on at least 200,000 Palestinians who have been separated in one form or another, or to one extent or another, have been separated from their agricultural lands. Many cases have lost access to their lands. Many people have had lands and homes destroyed or businesses destroyed for the construction of the wall. B'Tselem, the Israeli human rights group, writes that they feel that around 875,000 Palestinians will be directly harmed by the wall. Right now, 115,000 people are living between the barrier, the wall, and the Green Line, which is the border between Israel and the West Bank, and they're effectively trapped there. And about 13,000 of them have to now apply for permission to live in their homes. And they have to apply for permission from the Israeli authorities, and this permission is given, I believe, for a six-month period. More than a quarter of a million Palestinians will be trapped in enclaves and cantons to the east and west of the wall. And the wall will also separate about 200,000 Palestinians who live in East Jerusalem from the rest of the West Bank. And they also indicate that around 16% of the West Bank will be surrounded by barriers. And some people, some Palestinians will be totally encircled by the wall. So, of course, this is devastating not only from just a human point of view, but economically, people will lose their sources of livelihood.
When we talked last, the economic indicators were absolutely awful. A very high unemployment rate, mass impoverishment. I suppose things have only gotten worse since then in that regard, too.
And unemployment has come down a bit. It stands around, it hovers between 30 and about 33% right now, and that's primarily because the Israeli authorities are allowing some more people to enter Israel to work. But that's also, you know, that has to be understood as a temporary phenomenon. But still, a 30% unemployment rate, and this is the best rate it's been for quite a while, is still much higher than it was prior to the Intifada. And you have more people actually living in poverty now. The poverty rate increased, I believe, from about 21% in 2000 when the Intifada broke out to about 60% by 2002. And that's where it has remained more or less. And again, if you break it down regionally, certain parts of Gaza, poverty rate is as high as 80%. Certain parts of the West Bank, that's true as well. The separation barrier has exacerbated the suffering and the misery. And on top of that, you have continued land confiscations by the Israeli authority, continued settlement expansion, and the imposition of closure policy, and much more widespread and comprehensive closures.
The wall is presented here by Israel and its apologists as a security measure just designed to prevent terrorists from entering into Israel and blowing things up. What do you think the real reason is for building this wall?
Well, if you just look at a map of the wall, you can see that it has nothing to do with security, that it's a political barrier, and it's designed, in effect, to annex as much West Bank land into Israel as possible. I mean, I just read in a recent report that the Israeli government, I think it was a couple months ago or so, approved the extension of the wall approximately 14 miles inward to the West Bank to incorporate the Israeli settlement of Ariel. And if you look at the path of the wall, it's a very weaving path. It's curving inward as much as it can to incorporate settlements so that, in effect, everything that lies to the west of the wall, in effect, becomes part of Israel. And B'Tselem, I think, was the organization, one group, I think it was B'Tselem, who said that only 11% of the wall lies along the Green Line or the Israel West Bank border. So this, you know, one just has to look at the map and you see that this has nothing to do with security. In fact, the whole notion of separation barriers and walls and divisions and things of that sort has been talked about for a long time, and it was a platform on which former Prime Minister Barak ran. So this is not something that's new. In fact, one can trace it back even long before Barak, but the idea of this being a security measure is totally fallacious. In fact, if anything, it will decrease Israeli security rather than increase it, because it's impoverishing people, it's devastating communities, it's devastating the economy, it's devastating social life. What do you do with a population that is entrapped, that's losing its access to any source of livelihood, that has to apply for permission to live in homes they've occupied for generations? I mean, so on and so forth. It's absolutely absurd. And anybody who thinks that this barrier will somehow increase Israeli security is living in a fantasy world. I mean, if anything, it's going to create conditions that will make Israelis and Palestinians far more insecure, because for every, you know, attack or act of violence, it will be obviously met with another one. So it's a horrendous situation.
What do you think Israel's intention is with the Palestinians? Are they trying to make life so miserable they'll just somehow disappear, or pen them up into Bantustans? Or what's the strategy for the Palestinians behind the building of this wall?
In effect, you know, the idea has always been, with successive Israeli governments, the idea has been to try to control as much of the West Bank as possible. And different, you know, depending upon whether it's labor or the could, and in my view there isn't a substantial difference between them, but the differences have sort of broken down into ones of style more than anything else. But the idea, particularly with this government, is to increase the expansion of the state into Palestinian lands and to destroy the physical base of any potential future Palestinian state, and to displace, I think, as much of the indigenous population as is possible. And, you know, there's been a lot of talk now about the what they call the demographic threat, that in just a few years, the number of Palestinians will be greater than the number of Jews and Israelis. And the idea is, as well, if we're going to create a Jewish state, a state that's with a Jewish majority, how do we do this given the issues and problems that we, Israel, face? And one way is to annex as much land of the West Bank as possible, cantonize the remaining areas in a way that enables Israel to maintain control over the indigenous population, and make conditions so bad that people are, you know, encouraged to leave. And in fact, although we don't have accurate numbers because Palestinians don't control their borders, you know, there has been considerable emigration by Palestinians from the territories. In fact, those people with the means to do so, many have left, and the numbers that I've read, you know, have ranged anywhere from between 2,000 to over 100,000. This is also a problem that Israelis face too. I mean, there's been a large-scale emigration of people from Israel because conditions are so adverse inside Israel as well. And you know, those people, of course, who are leaving in both populations are the productive sectors of society. And so it has very, very real social and economic implications as well. But I think it's important to understand that the strategy, at least as I see it, is based on the government's desire here to control Arab land, or as much of it as possible, and perhaps relinquishing only small parts of it to create a somewhat diminished entity controlled by Israel. And the strategy may be that the idea is to give Palestinians more territorial contiguity in very, very small areas, you know, giving up some land to gain control, more control over other land areas. But basically giving them some sort of territorial contiguity in a very, very circumscribed or imprisoned area, and at the same time diminishing or altogether eliminating the possibility of Palestinians gaining control over the whole of the West Bank, Gaza, and East Jerusalem. And I think that's in large part what is behind this, you know, Sharon's call to evacuate the majority of settlements from the Gaza Strip.
Yeah, that was my next question. What do you make of that plan?
Well, you know, this is you know, while it certainly represents a reversal of Sharon's policies in terms of his position towards settlements in Gaza, it should also be understood as part of the same political continuum that was created by the Oslo process, indeed by Israeli policy since 67, beginning with the Alam Plan. And it should also be understood as serving the same goals, and those goals are to maintain full Israeli control, direct or indirect, over all Palestinian lands and resources, and perhaps most importantly, to consolidate and institutionalize direct and permanent military and political control over a majority of the West Bank, primarily through continued settlement expansion, the concentration of settlers in the main settlement blocks, which is a feature that has permeated all these so-called peace agreements, control over the Jordan Valley, which is key, and the building of the separation wall. And it also, you know, another goal, as I said earlier, was to ensure to the extent possible a demographic separation with Palestinians and thereby guaranteeing a Jewish majority within Israel, which now, of course, may include transferring some Arab Israeli citizens to a future Palestinian state, which is something the government announced a week or so ago. And to ensure that if a Palestinian state is declared, it will be weak and diminished and very dependent on Israel, a condition that Sharon believes Palestinians will have no choice but to accept. So, you know, the idea here with the Gaza evacuation plan is to withdraw most of the army from Gaza, not all of Gaza. They would still maintain control over the Egyptian border and apparently over Gush Katif, which is the main settlement block. But the majority of settlers would be removed, the army would be removed, but of course Israel would still control the borders. So Gaza would become a controlled canton. And in exchange, no doubt Sharon will argue that having relinquished Gaza, this will certainly strengthen his argument for maintaining control over key areas of the West Bank. This, in effect, has turned a political issue into a humanitarian issue. So it no longer becomes an issue of do the Palestinians have rights to their own country, to their own land, but how do we help Palestinians survive under current conditions?
And how could we do that?
Certainly, at the immediate level, it is essential to pressure the Israeli government to allow more relief to enter. In fact, conditions have become so bad in terms of the hostility expressed by the government, by the military, against foreigners generally, including relief organizations, human rights organizations, various NGOs working in the area, that some NGOs and international organizations are threatening to withdraw their operations completely because they're so encumbered in terms of their ability to move around due to closure restrictions and due to all these this rash of new military orders restricting the entry making it very difficult for foreigners to enter Gaza and the West Bank. And, of course, this is another way to try to isolate Palestinians from the rest of the world. The delivery of food and essential basic items has become very, very problematic. And this is not a new problem. This is a problem that has been there since the beginning of the current uprising. But it's become particularly acute right now. And it's very scary because the health status of the population, the humanitarian situation is so devastating and so alarming that if people are cut off or from food supplies and other sources of relief or those sources diminish, this will, of course, exacerbate an already alarming situation. In fact, the humanitarian situation, the health situation, I should say, is so bad that, you know, the people I talk to who live and work there and who are on the ground, as it were, say to me that, you know, this, for them, is the scariest and most serious problem. And, it gets so little attention in the popular press and media here. I mean, you have a situation where food, for the first time decades, really, food has become the number one priority of Palestinian families over employment. People simply do not have enough food to feed their families. There isn't, from everything I know and I've read and what I'm told, there isn't starvation. We're not at that level. But if the situation is allowed to continue and deteriorate as it has, we will face that. You have young children who are suffering severe acute malnutrition and at levels that we now find, can be found among certain countries in Africa. In fact, some of the levels in Palestine exceed the levels that you will find in sub-Saharan Africa. And this is absolutely devastating because prior to 2000, this just didn't exist. People are scared. You know, people who work there, international agencies, NGOs, as I said, people who deal with the population on a day-to-day basis and see this and live with it are absolutely terrified at what they're seeing. Nobody's doing much about it. And in fact, just as I said earlier, basic relief, food supplies, medical supplies, vaccinations, which have declined as well, are all encountering myriad problems. And, of course, this is compromising the health and nutritional state of the population even more. So this is something I would like to emphasize because people I know and trust who have been there for many, many years and who are, you know, serious development experts, as I would define them, are terrified about this, more so than any other thing. So what needs to be done, at least in the short and immediate term, I think, is for pressure to be put on the authorities to allow more food, more medical supplies, so on and so forth, to enter into the territories unencumbered on a regular, consistent basis. You know, allowing things in sporadically is not enough. And of course, over the longer term, ultimately the occupation has to end. I mean, pressure has to be brought to bear to end this very awful situation. Because I can tell you from everything that I know, and after almost two decades of living and working and writing about this area, that unless some sort of viable, meaningful Palestinian state or political entity is allowed to emerge, if this is not allowed or if this does not occur, then, you know, both peoples will be locked in a descending spiral of violence and despair. There's just no way around that.
And that was Sarah Roy, who is a senior scholar at the Harvard Center for Middle Eastern Studies, interview recorded earlier today. This is Doug Henwood. The show is Behind the News, WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, and on the web at WBAI.org. And let's move right along and listen to some excerpts from a presentation last night by George Soros at the Council on Foreign Relations, the elite ruling class confab. And he was talking about his new book, The Bubble of American Supremacy. George thinks that the American might is kind of like a financial market bubble that's on the verge of bursting. And he is devoting a lot of money to defeating George W. Bush this fall. He said he'd spend his old fortune if he had to, which is approaching $7 billion, I think. But he's only spent $12 million of it so far. Some folks think that he's... conspiracy-minded folks think he's going to engineer some kind of financial crisis that may be beyond his powers, but he does think one is coming. But anyway, let's listen to some excerpts from George Soros' presentation last night. And he was interviewed by the annoying and egregious Charlie Rose.
Supporting John Kerry?
I'm supporting any candidate that is selected. I was keen on Dean. I like Clark very much, whom I knew from the Balkans, and I'm delighted to have Kerry as the candidate, partly because he has reunited the Democratic Party, and partly because his formative experience was the Vietnam War. That's what brought him into politics. And to have a war hero who has experienced war and is opposed to going to war unless it's absolutely necessary, confront a president who wants to be a war president, but has personally avoided the experience of war. I think the choice is quite clear.
But 9/11 and the Bush reaction had what impact in terms of your own thinking about the administration and in terms of formulating how you wanted to be a player in this election?
Well, when I studied the situation, I discovered that there was this project on a new American century, which basically outlined a certain vision of American supremacy based on military power, more active use, projection of power, which had basically the signatories were then the people who were very closely associated with the Bush administration.
Cheney and Rumsfeld. And
yes, it wasn't...
Good Libby and others.
Yeah, it wasn't... it was Jeb Bush instead of George W. But it was basically the cast. And of course, that group had advocated the invasion of Iraq in 1998. So there was that ideology, a group in the government. Then came September 11, and that traumatic experience gave them the opportunity to implement their ideology, and that is what got me. When I supported the invasion of Iraq, of Afghanistan, that was a very appropriate reaction because when you want to fight, want to wage war on terrorism, you must have an address to find the terrorists. And in that case, bin Laden lived in Afghanistan, so that was appropriate to go.
So the Afghan war was appropriate.
Was appropriate response
to 9/11 and the attack on Afghanistan.
But then to use the war on terror as a way of implementing the invasion of Iraq and to pursue it irrespective of how Saddam responded, how the rest of the world responded, was, to me, a demonstration of having gone off the rails. And since the United States is so powerful, to have it go off the rails is a real danger to the world and to us. I think it endangered open society in this country and throughout the world.
How does it endanger open society?
Because a critical process is absolutely essential to an open society. And when Bush declared war on terrorism, it became impossible to criticize him without being unpatriotic. And when Bush said that those who are not not with me, are supporting the terrorists. I heard alarm bells. That is when I really became concerned. And in fact, if the critical process hadn't been suspended, because it was an emergency and a war and so on, then I don't think we would have ever gone to Iraq, because I don't think that it would have been possible to carry it through by hook or crook, because that is what we did.
Your central criticism, it seems to me, in reading a lot of, that you have said, is that you believe that the Bush administration wants to live by rules of power and not by rules of law.
Yes. That there is this belief that you know, it's a survival of the fittest. And who is the fittest is determined by competition and not cooperation.
And why is that detrimental to American interest?
Because, in fact, that is not... The use of power and dominance was not what has made America great and dominant. And now that we are dominant, it's a misuse of that power to try to impose our will on the world. As I say, with great power goes great responsibility. And our responsibility now is to help lead the world. I think that effectively our ability to project power has been greatly diminished by being bogged down as an occupying power in Iraq. I mean, I can't imagine us spending another $160 billion and putting soldiers at risk to remove another dictator. So I think we shot our whatever.
Yes.
If we had been concerned to be liberators, we would have gone about it another way. We would have protected not only the Ministry of Oil, but all the other ministries and hospitals and museums. We would have needed more troops to do it. Then we would have been liberators, and probably we would then be regarded as liberators. So we would have probably not given huge contracts to Halliburton, which then imports labor from Bangladesh, but actually given those reconstruction contracts that would employ people in Iraq. Unfortunately, to me, is a deception that we went there. And it upsets me the most, because it is a very legitimate objective to remove tyrants. And we must find ways of doing it. And by doing it this way, we lose the confidence of the world for cooperating in the future. Milosevic was actually committing genocide that prompted us to intervene. Saddam had also committed genocide. Killed, gassed the Kurds. But that was in 1985, and Rumsfeld went to Saddam and said, "Don't take our criticism too seriously. We still want to help you in your fight against Iran." So the same person now, 20 years later, claims that he's gone in there to remove a Saddam. That's deceptive, and it undermines our credibility.
My name is Alexander Cooley. I teach at Barnard College. I have a question about two of your areas of expertise, currency markets and international politics. With the recent fall of the dollar, how do you view medium and long-term impact or possible erosion of American power?
I think that the decline of the dollar has short-term beneficial effects for the American economy, and that is why it has been tacitly encouraged by the administration. It's a very dangerous game to play, because once you let the genie out of the bottle, it's very difficult to put it back again. And the global financial system is not functioning properly. The adjustment is not functioning properly, because more than half all of Asia, basically, is tied either directly or indirectly to the dollar. And therefore, the adjustment falls on the rest of the world. It's like a respiratory system with one lung collapsed. And therefore, the adjustment takes longer, and the goes too far, and it has the makings of an eventual crisis. We are on the road to a currency crisis of some kind.
Does that mean you're betting on the decline of the dollar?
I wouldn't like to say.
My name is Eugene Staples. Are we not greatly handicapped in considering all of the issues that you have put before us by the use of the term the war on terrorism, which is, it seems to me, an unending war that probably never will end? And should we not really be seeking some other term to change the semantics of this debate?
The answer is yes.
Yeah. So what's the term?
Well, I in the book, I said the terrorist attack was a crime against humanity, basically, and it ought to be treated as a crime, and you need to, you can't wage war against terrorists, because in order to wage war, you must have an address where you know they live, so you can bomb them. Since the terrorists are invisible, when you engage in military action, you're liable to have innocent victims. And in fact, the war on terror has already had more innocent victims than were killed in the World Trade Center, except that they are somewhere else, and so we don't draw that comparison. But it is a very, it's a very counterproductive way to go, because of course we have to take precautions, we have to increase various security arrangements, but to win the war on terror, you need to get the win the hearts and minds of the populations where the terrorists live, and that is where we have failed.
And that was George Soros speaking last night at the Council on Foreign Relations on Park Avenue in Manhattan, interviewed by Charlie Rose and questioned by assorted members of the ruling class. At those events, the members of the press are not allowed to ask questions. Only members of the council are allowed to ask questions. And we just sit there mutely and receive the wisdom of our betters. And we're back here on Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, WBAI 99.5 FM in New York, and on the web at WBAI.org. And now we're joined in the studio by Christian Parenti, who has been a frequent guest in the studio in the last few months, talking about his visits to Iraq and his book, The Soft Cage. And he's got another splendid piece in the February 23rd issue of The Nation magazine on his recent visit to Iraq. He spent pretty much the month of January there, right, Christian?
That's right.
And instead of hanging out with a bunch of bored reservists with a bad attitude, you were hanging out with some serious trained killers, right, the 82nd Airborne?
Yes, the 82nd Airborne in Fallujah. And there's sort of two cultures among the troops. There's the reservists who are treated pretty poorly by the military and aren't really told how long they're going to be there in many cases, and have their deployments extended again and again and again, and have a pretty bad attitude. And then there's the professional military, whose morale is not necessarily great, because morale is never great when soldiers are being shot at and blown up, but who are very well trained, very well supplied, and, you know, very disciplined. And the military is very different from what it was at the end of the Vietnam War. And the Army went through a process of really trying to transform its culture, which had become unruly and riddled with rebellion during Vietnam. And so you see a type of discipline in the professional army that's in many ways very, pardon the phrase, but sort of Foucauldian. You know, it's not about focusing on the body, like punishing soldiers when they mess up by making them do push-ups and run around, but it's about inculcating in their minds and everyday habits meticulous and minute forms of discipline. So remember, a soldier left his gun on the truck on the base when he went to chow hall. So his punishment wasn't push-ups or that. It was that he had to do sensitive item inventory twice a day and go through and make sure that he could account for every grenade and all the weapons that his squad had. So the Army is really, really intensely disciplined, and there's no drinking. And so that's the situation with the 82nd Airborne. And they live outside Fallujah, which is one of the roughest towns in Iraq, and make often usually very quick raids in and out of Fallujah.
Yeah, they're at high risk of being attacked if they spend more than a couple of minutes there, right?
If they spend more than an hour there, they usually get attacked. And they so as a result, they try and go in on these real specific nighttime raids. But they also do these longer raids. One I went on was an all-day cordon search, and they were attacked twice with RPGs and small arms fire, and a Bradley fighting vehicle was knocked out, but the crew wasn't in the vehicle, so no one was killed or injured, but the thing was messed up and had to be towed out of there. And so, I mean, as people know, Fallujah is a town in open rebellion. The resistance overran the police station, killed a lot of the cops, attacked General Abizad, commander of Central Command, I cannot believe that the man thought he was going to walk around in Fallujah. It really makes you wonder where these people are getting their information at the higher levels of the military. So, yeah, that's the situation in Fallujah.
And what's the attitude of the soldiers? Do they just think it's a job, or are they really into killing Arabs? What's their attitude towards what they're doing?
No, they're very professional. You find soldiers who say, you know, if it's up to me, we just kill them all. But there are also soldiers who question what the whole mission is about. Is it just about oil? Is it right for us to be searching these people's houses? Soldiers who, you know, say, I don't like putting a sandbag over someone's head when I arrest them. But the main thing is, you know, they have a mission, and there's this culture of compartmentalization. It's not up to them to decide whether the policy is any good. They have to do a specific task within a larger mission, and that kind of thinking is inculcated throughout the culture of the military. For example, I was interested to find out that a lot of the officers I interviewed, basically all of the officers, had engineering or chemistry degrees. No one studied social sciences, so there's kind of like mechanical thinking, which is exactly what you need when you're building suspension bridges. But that is sort of the dominant paradigm for officers who are addressing highly complicated political and cultural interactions. And that thinking of just sort of like, you know, compartmentalizing tasks, keeping things simple is the way the Army reproduces itself and gets things done. And, the 82nd Airborne are an extremely lethal organization, but they're not... You know, they're not like a bunch of rabid killers. They're just like working class kids who, time and time again, I ran into people who they would explain how they got into the military. It almost sounded like, how did you get that tattoo? They'd be like, well, you know, I was staying at my parents' house, like sleeping on the couch until 11, and this recruiters came by each morning, and finally, you know, they showed me these really cool videos, and I was like, I really should get my life together, and I signed up, and now I'm in Iraq with the 82nd Airborne.
He gets.
Yeah.
And you also met up with some resistance people. How'd that happen, and what was that like?
Well, ever since I went there the first time in August, I was wondering, you know, who are the resistance? And there had been some interviews, some pretty good stories in between my two trips with the resistance. But I'd always wanted to find out, really, who are they? What are they about? So I went, and the translator that I worked with both times is a young guy who's brave enough to sort of pursue such stories. And it was just a matter of, the thing is, in Iraq, nobody likes the occupation. Nobody likes the occupation, even if they hated Saddam Hussein or whatever. So there's a lot of sympathy for the resistance. And if you speak Arabic or you have someone who speaks Arabic, it's not that hard, if you're trusted, to make contact with people who have contact with the resistance. And from there, try and make direct contact with the resistance. There are whole towns in, like in Sumara, nobody is allowed to speak with the American military. Any Iraqi who goes and talks to the American military is killed by the resistance. The mayor of Sumara was having negotiations with the resistance. So there's this whole other, you know, parallel world that the American occupiers can't penetrate, but is fairly easy to get entree to if one speaks Arabic and is with Iraqis that are trusted. And so he and I went to a neighborhood where there's heavy resistance and asked people and just sort of did classic journalistic methods, followed up links until we found a guy who was known to be a funder of the resistance. And he sort of checked me out to make sure I wasn't CIA, and sort of had to show him my books that I'd written. And, you know, they obviously Googled me.
Which fortunately you'd taken to Iraq with you.
I did. Well, precisely for that reason, in part, because I wanted to meet the resistance. And I figured like that would be somehow useful. And it turned out that it was. And so I had to meet a series of, as I explained in the article in The Nation, you know, a series of people who were essentially vetting me, some of who'd said they were with the resistance and some of whom said they weren't. And then finally got an interview with a resistance fighter in Adamiya, which is this neighborhood in Baghdad, right on the Tigris in sort of north-central Baghdad. It's where James Nachwe and the guy Weisskopf from Time magazine were wounded on December 10th. And it's considered one of the most dangerous neighborhoods for the U.S. military because there's a lot of former Ba'athist officers who live there. And they're the kind of the hardcore of the resistance, intelligence officers and army officers who kept fighting. So that was one kind of component of the resistance. And then later, I met a group of retired or maybe momentarily retired resistance fighters in a farm town on the Tigris near Balad, which is north of Baghdad. And that was just sort of through people who knew people. And we went up there, and they trusted us. This group of brothers and cousins had conducted numerous operations against the Americans, and were now had decided to drop out, or so they said. In part because the Americans in that section of Iraq were using really intense counterinsurgency methods. They had surrounded a whole village with barbed wire and threatened to deport the population to the east of Iraq if there were still a whole bunch of attacks. They've arrested a lot of people. And so that I think, was having an impact to some extent.
I'm speaking with Christian Parenti, author of Two Sides, Scenes from a Nasty British and Long War, about his January visit to Iraq, which appeared in the February 23rd issue of The Nation magazine. And who are, I mean, aside from the specific resistance people you talked with, I mean, who more broadly are they? What social forces, what ideological forces do they represent?
I think that they are primarily former military. One doesn't just teach themselves how to unscrew a giant mortar round or an artillery round and turn it into a roadside bomb. That's pretty complicated stuff. So just that in itself indicates that there's a lot of militarily trained people in the resistance. And I think that there's a collection of kind of like former Ba'athist intelligence officers, military officers, who believe in sort of the ideals of the Ba'ath Party, strangely kind of transmogrified and corrupted by the various stages of Saddam Hussein's rule. So, I mean, it's sort of an incoherent ideology at this point. It's not what it started out as in the 70s. But that they're also religious. They believe in Islam. But they're not Wahhabist. They're not like Al-Qaeda, Saudi Arabia-style devout Wahhabists, but they're just mainline Sunni Muslims, and they feel that the occupation is a humiliation, you know, nationally, and there's a basic Iraqi nationalism motivating them, and which then gets pressed through a sort of a religious sensibility. So that is who they are, by and large. And I think to some extent some reports have tried to downplay the role of the former military, because that sounds too much like endorsing Donald Rumsfeld's version of what the Iraqi resistance are, these dead-enders. But I think that they are primarily former military, but that doesn't mean they're dead-enders. It's not. I mean, what's going on here is clearly not is something much greater than a mop-up operation against the former regime. Which gets
well, they keep telling us it's going away, but it doesn't seem to be going away.
It doesn't seem to be going away, no. I really don't know what will happen. I can't predict what will happen. All I can say is that the American counterinsurgency methods are effective. They are arresting thousands of people. They are breaking up these resistance cells. They're confiscating weapons. But they're also constantly alienating people and humiliating people in really, really profound ways. And that the anger generated by the occupation, I think, is fueling the continued reproduction of the resistance. Now, does the repression mop up more resistance than it creates? I don't know. We'll see.
But what can you tell about how popular Iraqi population doesn't like the occupation, and they're probably happy to see the Americans take a hit. But how do people feel more broadly about what the resistance represents and what it might mean for Iraq's future?
You know, those discussions didn't happen very often, and people were very kind of confused about that level of projecting things into the future. They just sort of wanted the Americans out. They liked that the resistance was attacking Americans. They didn't like it when the resistance did attacks that hurt civilians. But so there's just this baseline kind of general nationalism and faith in the nation. But of course, people hold, you know, there's massive cognitive dissonance. People hold these really contradictory ideas without any problem. So
you mentioned a guy who was tortured by Saddam's regime, who nonetheless admired Saddam.
Mm-hmm. He was a young guy who had been forced into the Fedayeen because he was a martial artist and an A student. And the Fedayeen, which was like a paramilitary sort of domestic terror police force, run by Uday Hussein, they came to his school and they basically just press ganged him into joining. And he said, I don't want to join them. You know, I'm my mother's only son. They said, no, you're Iraq's son. And so they made him join the Fedayeen. He was in the Fedayeen for 3 months and he had to do stuff like jump out of helicopters into the Tigris River. And when they were jumping out, there was like 100 of them in these Chinook helicopters or big helicopters. And the guy in charge said, he's like, I want five, you know, five of you are going to die. Five of you aren't going to come back from this. And they took this, they made them like throw innocent people out of helicopters and just awful, awful stuff. And he was only 19. And so finally he shot himself in the knee to get out of it. And they were like, oh yeah, that's the oldest trick in the book. You were cleaning your pistol and you shot yourself in the knee. So they put him in prison for like 32 days and tortured him. But then they realized that he wasn't actually a spy, that he was just a 19-year-old kid who couldn't hack this, and so they let him go home. And he felt really like strangely connected to Saddam Hussein, because he was raised in a society where Saddam Hussein's picture was everywhere, where Saddam Hussein, you know, had gassed Kurds, but then would also go and dress up as a Kurd and visit Kurds, and was all things to all people, would go pray at Shia mosques after having, you know, put down Shia rebellions with utmost brutality. And so this guy was raised in this bizarre, this surreal ideological environment where Saddam was the center of the world, and the kind of emotional structure connection that created with Saddam isn't really rational, but it was very real. And so he didn't particularly like Saddam's government. He didn't like his sons, but he really liked Saddam Hussein, and he cried when Saddam was captured. And he felt like, I interviewed many Sunni at least, who felt personally sort of like that the whole nation had been humiliated when Saddam was captured and examined by the doctor. They just thought that was a real deep and intentional humiliation of the nation.
Which it was, no doubt.
Yes, it was. It's true.
But it sounds like the whole country's in the grip of something like a post-traumatic stress disorder, and they're not getting any relief from the stress and the trauma.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a good way to put it. I mean, what's arising in its place are these, you know, increasingly fundamentalist religious movements, kind of retrograde nationalism, general criminality, and a kind of hopelessness.
When I saw you shortly after you got back, you said you thought that nothing, you couldn't see how anything good could come of all this. That if there were some kind of elections, might bring a religious government to power. If the occupation continues, it's just nothing but colonial occupation. It's you got resistance forces that are kind of not the nicest folks around, spreading violence. So it's hard to see a way out. Are you still feeling that way?
I'm not feeling as pessimistic as I was when I first came back. I think because I don't think there's going to be a civil war. Like, I don't think that Iraq is going to explode into a massive kind of Yugoslavia-style civil war with ethnic cleansing. And I've been heartened by the way that the Shia leadership has been playing their cards. And there's also been this development of a political leadership among the Sunni, the Shura Council, which is a bunch of Sunni clerics who've come together to sort of represent Sunni interests nonviolently. So when I'm feeling hopeful, I imagine a kind of a multi-ethnic, probably very religious and probably very oppressive, misogynist state in many ways, developing, but one that is not terribly brutal and not a puppet of the U.S. and that might make an international issue of the question of resources and the U.S. attempt to seize resources directly and indirectly through debt and privatization, all that. So there's some hope on that front that there might be kind of a nationalist opposition to this U.S. Resource grab. But ultimately, yeah, no, it's a horrible situation. The secular left has been destroyed in Iraq and throughout the Middle East by U.S.-backed repression, and also by the fact that the left or left forces got into power in many places. To some extent, the Ba'athists represented that and were totally brutal and totally corrupt. And so the ideas of secular leftist socialist thinking are very, very marginalized, and that's really depressing. And the Communist Party is collaborating with the CPA. There's a radical party, but it's the Iraqi Workers Communist Party, and they have a splendid analysis of the problem in the Middle East and Iraq, which places gender equality at the center of the class struggle. But culturally, you know, they seem to me to be very out of step with where the average Iraqi is, which is now the average Iraqi is in a rather sort of religious posture.
All right, we have to bring it to a close there. Thanks for joining us, Christian Parenti, and his piece, Two Sides, Scenes from a Nasty British and Long War, is in the February 23rd issue of The Nation magazine. Thank you.
Thanks for having me on the show.
And that's it for me, Doug Hinwood. Stay tuned for the news and on to the evening. Until next week, good. Let's get out with this from Dmitry Shostakovich.